Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where Easter baskets can be filled with chef-prepared holiday meals, Easter lilies, Easter candy, and more.
We've been exploring the history of the Republican Party in Utah over the last few weeks because we wanted to see how the party has evolved over time and whether or how Donald Trump has changed its character. And there's a legend you hear about the state's political history, that when Mormon leaders were lobbying for statehood, they realized they had to convince Congress there was political diversity here, only there wasn't really. Mormons voted in a block, so church leaders divided up ward congregations and assigned people a party. When we talked to the journalist Rod Decker, he had a version of that story.
David O. McKay told this story. He grew up in Huntsville. He said the elders came, and by the time they got to the McKay house, everybody had chosen all the Republican slots. So the McKays had to be Democrats. And he said, quote, "How ashamed we were to be Democrats in those days. The only Democrat before had been the town drunk." So there was some assignment and there was some stories about it.
The problem is, like a lot of good stories, it's probably too good to be true. But the historian Benjamin Park told us the real story might be just as interesting. He says, yes, Utah desperately wanted to be a state, and the Republican Party could help them do just that.
So while there's a lot of family lore and stories passed down about members being divided at meetings by church leaders into Democrat and Republican camps, we actually don't have any evidence that that literally took place. However, as is the case with most folkloric stories, there is a thematic truth to it. It's, we'll call it spiritually true, because it was very much the case that in the 1890s, LDS leaders were concerned that there was not enough political diversity among the membership. So over the previous few years, there had been some tentative talks with the Republican Party. The national GOP as a political power had been losing a lot of its dominance. And as a result, the Republican Party, and especially the political operators, were seeking for ways to shore up their political dominance. And one of the ways they could do that would be building alliances out in the West. There are all of these Western territories, of which Utah was one, that still were not states. And so the GOP made a conscious decision of, well, maybe we should find ways to curry favor with these Western territories so that when they become states, we can form an impenetrable voting bloc that will reassert our dominance in national politics. So at one of the darkest moments of the LDS Church, the spring and summer of 1890, when it seemed like the church was about to be disincorporated and many of the leaders were going to be thrown in jail, George Q. Cannon, a member of the First Presidency, travels to Washington, D.C., meets with several political operatives, including from the Republican Party, and their meeting goes much better than expected. Up until this time, Cannon had mostly been working with the Democrats. But now, talking with these Republicans, the very same politicians who had been presenting anti-polygamy legislation and had been throwing LDS leaders in jail, told him, well, if it's a matter of politics and Latter-day Saints were able to shift their allegiances, there might be a new agreement that we can reach here. And Cannon left that meeting convinced that if the Latter-day Saints could show more support for the Republicans and, importantly, give up polygamy, they might have political salvation here. And then later that fall, they issue the manifesto on polygamy, saying the church is no longer going to be practicing. And by the next year, Cannon and other LDS leaders are working with Republican operatives in the territory of Utah to try to turn more Latter-day Saints toward the Republicans. So Mormon leaders were very conscious of wanting to appear like they are not meddling in political affairs, because to be able to gain acceptance and live up to their bargain, they had to operate within the American model of moral persuasion and personal freedom that the ecclesiastical officers are not telling you who to vote for, while at the same time, they are really trying to tell members who they should vote for. And I think it's that dynamic that gets captured so perfectly in the folkloric tales of LDS leaders getting up on the pulpit at sacrament meeting and saying, you half are going to vote for Republicans, you half are going to vote for the Democrats. Because that was the implication of what was going on, even if it wasn't literally true. What actually happened was that several prominent LDS leaders who leaned Republican were sent on speaking tours across Utah territory, basically to say, like, hey, maybe y'all should consider the Republicans. And so those weren't explicitly religious gatherings, but they are political gatherings by religious authorities, symbolizing the merging spheres here. Other LDS leaders like Joseph F. Smith, the son of Hiram Smith, nephew of Joseph Smith, writes a pamphlet on why Utah should vote Republican, which seems to give an impromptu of support, or at the very least, a chain of approval. And then by 1894, a Republican-controlled legislature is able to push through the statehood bill. It's signed by a Republican president, and Utah finally becomes a state after four decades of fighting for that victory.
The historian Benjamin Park. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few weeks ago now, the New York Times published a piece that described Utah as a lonely holdout in a Republican Party now fully in thrall of the MAGA movement. The reporter Kellen Browning said the state remained a redoubt of a kinder, gentler, and more civil kind of Republicanism. Sometimes you'll hear it described as the Utah way. And we wanted to investigate that idea and also explore whether Donald Trump has had some kind of effect on the party. But to get a better view, let's go back to the history. Here's Rod Decker again.
From 1896, statehood, till 1976, the election of Gerald Ford, there were 20 presidential elections. Utahns voted for the winner in 17 of those. Utah was a mainstream state. It swung with the nation. When the nation went Democratic, Utah went Democratic. When the nation went Republican, Utah went along with them. Utah was a moderate swing state. It takes an effort of imagination to think of that.
Yeah.
But it was true for 80 years.
So what were the issues that mattered to Utahns when they were swinging back and forth? Like, what were the issues at play going on at the time?
The issues in early statehood were economic issues, particularly the tariff. Utah was like an underdeveloped country. They extracted natural resources. And Utah couldn't have survived, maybe, without tariffs. Sugar needed protection from Cuban cane. Wool needed protection from Australia. Silver, that wasn't protection, but that was silver coinage. There was an ad that ran in the Salt Lake Tribune, an election ad. Copper, sugar, wool. Vote Republican. Republicans were for high tariffs on commodities that helped Utah. Democrats were Southern-based, and they were for high tariffs on things that Utah bought that would cost Utah money. So Utah was Republican on economic issues. But then when they got Democratic, was during the New Deal. And then Utah was one of the hardest hit states in the Great Depression. Franklin D. Roosevelt, the New Deal offered a program and hope, and Utah, over the objections of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Utah went strongly Democratic.
Okay, so let's talk about the church part, because this is a really important theme in your book. You wrote that the religious split is the most important fact about Utah politics.
Okay, Utah has the most religiously divided electorate of any state. Political science studies show that. Latter-day Saints vote Republican. Everyone else, every other religion or no religion, votes pretty strongly Democratic. Latter-day Saints. If you look at presidential votes, they're about 70% since 1976. Starting in 1976 till now, about 70% of Latter-day Saints vote Republican in any given presidential election. About 55 to 57% of non-Mormons vote Democratic. That's a really high percentage. Utah would be one of the most Democratic states if no Mormons could vote. So there's a religious divide that began before, there were inklings of it, but got serious in 1976 with the election of Gerald Ford.
How do you explain what the Mormon vote was before? Let's talk about before there were social issues. I mean, there were always social issues, but I mean the really intense social issues that come in the 1970s, which we'll get to. But what was the Mormon sensibility for, like, political sensibility in those early days?
Okay, it was mixed and it was complicated. Often, Latter-day Saints voted as their leaders suggested. In 1912, Woodrow Wilson won, but President Joseph F. Smith of the church endorsed Taft, and Utah was one of two or three states that went for William Howard Taft, probably because of the endorsement.
Wow.
But by no means did they always follow the church. In the New Deal, when Alf Landon ran against Franklin D. Roosevelt, there was a front-page editorial in the Deseret News that endorsed Alf Landon. It didn't say vote for Alf Landon.
Right.
What it said was there are two candidates. One of them doesn't care about the Constitution, has said it's outmoded. That's Roosevelt. The other stands for the Constitution, and we know the Constitution is divinely inspired. Nonetheless, Roosevelt carried Utah by over 60%, and the church hasn't endorsed a presidential candidate since.
What happens in 1976? Because this is the big shift.
Well, first off, it's the election after Roe v. Wade. 73 is Roe v. Wade. Now, for a time, Latter-day Saints had been becoming more Republican, but they weren't seriously Republican until after 1976. It wasn't clear how big a deal Roe v. Wade was because it happened at the same time as Watergate, or nearly the same time. But since Roe v. Wade, Latter-day Saints have voted strongly Republican. And it started with the presidential level, went to Congress and senators, went to the governor, pretty soon every county commissioner, except for Salt Lake or a few, were Republicans. And Roe v. Wade was the tipper. In the gubernatorial election before Roe v. Wade, Cal Rampton ran against Nick Strike. Nick Strike was pro-choice, or relatively. He said, we've got to change our abortion laws. They aren't working. Cal Rampton said, if the legislature changes the abortion law, I'll veto it. He was strongly pro-life.
Yeah.
It wasn't much of a political issue. They said it, and no one paid much attention to it because it wasn't going to happen. And nationally, abortion was not a large political issue. Before Roe v. Wade, Republicans were slightly more pro-choice than Democrats.
Wait, because say that again. Republicans were.
Okay. Before Roe v. Wade, Republicans were slightly more pro-choice than Democrats. That's because Democrats had more Catholics. And after Roe v. Wade, Congress had to scramble around and do a bunch of stuff with Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, to adjust the laws. In those adjustments, the parties took sides. The Democrats ended up pro-choice, the Republicans pro-life, and it became a fierce and long-standing political issue. And so in both Utah and America, Roe v. Wade made a huge difference. And in Utah, it made a big political difference. It made a difference religiously. Roe v. Wade meant that conservative religions became strongly Republican, a pillar of the Republican Party. So what was a major change in America was a tsunami in Utah, and it's lasted ever since. But then we've had a succession that's still going on of what social scientists would call social issues. Latter-day Saints might call them family issues.
Right.
There was abortion. Then there was pornography. There was censoring cable television. There was birth control for teenagers supplied by government grants without telling their parents. That was a big issue here. The Equal Rights Amendment, gay marriage. And now we're talking about the rights of transgender people, and that's sort of a continuation.
Are Utah Republicans distinctive to national Republicans in any significant way?
Well, a little, for the reason that most national Republicans aren't Latter-day Saints.
Yeah.
And while evangelicals have similar family values to Latter-day Saints, and that's an important factor, a lot of Republicans are libertarians of one sort or another and believe that government ought not to be encouraging people not to look at pornography or whatever the issue is of freedom versus virtue. Mm. And Latter-day Saints believe government ought to actively promote virtue. So, yeah, I think there is a difference. In a presidential election or in the people we send to Congress, it doesn't show up very much.
Here's what you wrote in your book. The 2016 election of Donald Trump was an exception that showed a moral component of LDS voting.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say this is where Latter-day Saints may diverge a little bit from the quote-unquote family values?
To the extent they vote for Trump, they diverge quite a bit, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'll explain this. In 2016, Utah was the state that voted Republican that voted the least Republican. A minority of Utahns voted for Trump. Now, in I think it was the 12 elections before that, Utahns had been first for the Republican seven times. They'd been the most Republican state most of the time. They were the least Republican state for Trump. Why? Well, listen to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney came to the University of Utah and gave a speech, and he said, Trump bragged about adultery. How can you vote for a man who brags about his adultery? And that resonated. Utah still is just sort of a middling Republican state after three goes at Trump. Utah voted against Trump for the nomination whenever it had a chance to do so. Utah Republicans have not been strong for Trump, though they have been converted in large measure. As Trump has shown he can win, and as Trump has won Republican votes, he's also won more Utah Republicans.
So if he's not appealing necessarily on the, quote, family values part, what's the part that's appealing to Utah voters, Latter-day Saints, about Donald Trump?
First, what Republicans like about Trump most is that he wins. He's won twice. Next, Utahns harbor hard feelings, or Utah Republicans harbor hard feelings against the federal government. Part of it's the moral issues that we've been talking about. Part of it's federal land. And so here's a guy who hits back at the federal government. He fires him. He says things that are outrageous. He makes liberals so angry. And if you're a Utah Republican, you think, good, it's time that they got a little angry. They've had things their own way for too damn long now, and they were pretty uppity about it. So they like Trump on that score.
So what effect do you think Donald Trump is going to have on Utah politics? Or the state itself?
He's having an effect now. Legislators, they have come to believe that Donald Trump may be right about things. For example, Donald Trump is highly critical of higher education. He believes, what is true, that people in higher education are strongly Democratic. Donald Trump criticizes this. The legislature, or some legislators at least, have come to say that's true, and so they're kicking around higher education, and one would guess that they'll do that for a while, then they'll get over it, the same as they get over most things. He may have some effect on immigration. Immigration is one of the issues that got him elected. Utah has a tradition of being relatively welcoming on immigration. In 2010, the legislature passed a law called the Utah Compact at the urging of leaders of the LDS Church and of other churches, and it was welcoming to immigrants and was immediately struck down by federal courts. And Utah has a tradition of being welcoming. That might change. Governor Cox says he's in favor of Donald Trump's deportation policy insofar as it applies to criminals.
Do you think when you look at these critical moments that shifted Utah politics, I'm thinking about FDR, I'm thinking about 1976, where would the emergence of Donald Trump fit?
My guess is it will be much less than statehood, FDR, or 1976.
Rod Decker, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Fun.
Rod Decker, he's a former reporter for KUTV Channel 2. He has a book called Utah Politics, The Elephant in the Room.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where Easter baskets can be filled with chef-prepared holiday meals, Easter lilies, Easter candy, and more.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Republican Party in Utah, and we're examining whether Donald Trump has weakened or altered the Utah way, this idea that Utah politicians are more civil, more moderate, and more cooperative than in other places. David Magleby has been documenting the party's shift to the right over the last 8 years. He's a professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University, and he actually put together a list showing how the MAGA agenda has impacted Utah politics. He started with education.
They become much more intrusive into policy about education. I'm thinking of book bans. I'm thinking about LGBTQ flags, pride flags. They wanted to reinforce partisanship and of a particular kind of partisanship on school boards. And so they made the state school board elections partisan, where they had not been before. More immediately, there is a strong anti-union hostility in the legislature. This is not new, but it's manifest in what I will call the anti-collective bargaining, but really anti-UEA legislation, which may go to a referendum, in which case we'll get a third vote on these issues. And it'll be interesting to see if the rank-and-file voters in the state are as committed to some of this as the legislature is. But public education has long been a cornerstone of, I will call it, the Utah way. It was a strong emphasis for much of Utah history.
Let me ask you about elections. This seems like, I think, objectively, one of the most striking turnabouts. It wasn't long ago when Utahns were mostly proud of their mail-in voting system. Now it's being limited, attempts to eliminate it altogether. This seems to have the marks of Donald Trump. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. There's good data on this. Damon Kahn and I, he's at Utah State in the political science department, did quite a bit of work on this as the state transitioned to statewide vote by mail. Utah voters very much like it. Rural voters like it even more. You can understand why. They have to drive a long way, and it's a season where they're still busy harvesting and so forth. So they should be careful here, because this has been a reform that the voters liked, that saved the state money. In fact, it was clear one reason we went to vote by mail is the state could not have afforded to replace the touchscreen ballot machines. They were simply going to be too expensive to replace. We had to find a more economical way, and vote by mail is that. But this is part of the attack on democracy that Trump has launched and repeatedly launched. So let me give you a couple of other examples. The questioning of election outcomes, that where there was widespread fraud or abuse, is personified in the claims of Donald Trump. All of those were clearly rejected after the 2000 2020 election. But they've come back to Utah through the person of Phil Lyman, who won't let it go. Yeah. But it extends beyond that to the ideology. The ideology is make participation hard. Limit participation to only the true believers, the zealots. That's why they don't want to have signatures qualifying people to be on the primary ballot. But it is an attack on democracy and an effort to make voting hard by requiring this and that to be done to the mail ballots, when in fact, there is no problem there.
Let me just have you say something about public health, how Donald Trump may have transformed the attitude toward public health, I guess, in Utah. I mean, Utah is the first state to ban fluoride in drinking water. The desire to ban fluoride has been around with conservatives for decades and decades. But is this a case where the state may be leading out on some of these, you know, Trump initiatives?
The answer is yes. Now, this is not entirely new to the Trump second administration, because we saw some of this in the first Trump administration in Utah as well, where there was hostility to public health, criticism from the legislature and others on school closures and masking and vaccination policies. This was an example where I think elites in the state rallied to the science, if you will, of how to deal with COVID, which was pretty clear. Given all that was happening, it was a dynamic environment, but very clear, I think. There was, I think, a fairly widespread support at the grassroots level. But I think, as we saw with the heads of public health in Utah and others, there was also quite a bit of hostility and criticism. And now it's surfacing with fluoridation. So the extent that we're talking about a trend, Doug, I think we can look for bans on red food dyes to be something that will come up in future legislatures.
Yeah.
I think we will see more aggressive parental rights with respect to vaccinations, movements, and it'll be very interesting to see how the public health and pediatric and so forth, other medical communities respond to this, because the state has been quite good compared to many states in following the science. But there's now, I think, a counter movement.
What do you think is going to be the place of moderates in the Republican Party in Utah going forward? It seemed in the past, to me, a love, and there have been certainly others, for a time anyway, Spencer Cox, who were critical of Donald Trump. Is that going to happen anymore? Are they going to be required Republican candidates in this state to toe the line with Donald Trump, or just expect to get primaried in the same way?
Well, I think they fully expect to be primaried if they don't toe the line.
Yeah.
And he will lead the parade in attacking them and helping to fund their opponents. He now has a colleague, and Mr. Musk will help him with that. So I think the indicators are people like Mitt Romney, who chose not to run again, perhaps for multiple reasons, but I think one of them was he just didn't want to have to deal with that. I'm not at all sure he wouldn't have prevailed in a primary. But what voters lack within this large mega party called the Republican Party in Utah is a voting alternative. They had that in 2016 with Evan McMullen. And when they had that in 2016, a substantial percentage of them, 20% or so, voted for McMullen and not for Trump. Trump did not get a majority of Utah votes in 2016. He fell short of 50%, in large part because of McMullen.
Yeah.
Certainly it wasn't the draw of Hillary Clinton that moved them away from Trump, given their hostility to the Clintons. That is Republicans, I'm saying.
Right.
So The problem that a moderate has is, how do I run and win given this predominance now, unless I'm quite visible? So a Romney who's quite visible could have taken on this this group, this faction, but there aren't very many others. But that could change. And I think the times to watch for the change will be the 2028 election, and especially even the 2026 election.
The midterms.
If some of these Republicans are performing much worse than they have been, and maybe even one of them defeated, and I don't want to generalize from these town halls, but the level of intensity at the town hall at the U of U was remarkable. Much more like the Tea Party period that Republicans mounted in 2010. If that passion continues through the election and supposed Republicans decide this is enough and are willing to vote for some Democrat, then that will be the signal, watch out for myself. Another harbinger will be to watch John Curtis, because he doesn't have to run in 2026, and he doesn't have to run in 2028.
Right.
So if he can survive to 2027, he then may get a ticket to be perhaps somewhat different in his voting or his positioning. There have been some signals that he's inclined that way in his behavior in the House with respect to the environment issue, and in his rumored position that he was against Congressman Gates being nominated for the cabinet. That was never fully confirmed, and there was never a vote, but there were articles that said six Republican senators have indicated they will vote no, and as you may remember, the Trump administration withdrew Gates. So I think Curtis is suspect to some of those folks. He will be another marker. And then will somebody like Henderson, lieutenant governor, decide she's going to run for governor and position herself more to the center than the Phil Lyman faction of the Republican Party?
I guess let me ask you finally this. Has Donald Trump changed Utah Republicans for good, or at least for a generation or so? And when you look through the lens of history, I guess I'll go back to that first question we were talking about. Is this a blip, or is it a significant reshaping of the party, its ideology, its tactics, its ideas, its characters? What do you think?
I think we don't know yet, and I think it could become more permanent. A lot of it depends on the next 2 years and what happens with all of these initiatives. And some of them are embraced by what I'll call mainstream Republicans, which I would have described the Utah Republican Party as, but I don't think it is anymore. So if, for example, we have further embarrassments on the international stage, if, for example, Ukraine becomes Trump's Afghanistan, and the Putin forces moving in only reinforce the possible mistake of abandoning Ukraine, or if there are real cuts to Social Security or Medicare, or even real serious threats to cut. So far, they just become hints. But a lot of Utahns depend on Medicare and Social Security. And when that issue has surfaced in the past, as it has occasionally, from the Republican side of the aisle to try and privatize or scale back or whatever, it has come back to hurt them very badly. And I think that could undo this connection to Trump in a substantial way by as early as the 2026 election, depending on what happens in the next 18 months. But we're at a pivot point, not only nationally, but in Utah. If the Trump team does not deliver on these major issues that I've just described and a few others as well, then I think some Republicans are going to look for an alternative.
David Magleby, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Fred.
David Magleby, he's a professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University.
So Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Becky Edwards is a torchbearer, a defender of the political style that's come to be known as the Utah Way. She worked as a licensed marriage and family therapist before she got into politics. She served in the Utah House from 2009 to 2018. And she's, I don't know, convivial. She's a moderate, a Republican from Davis County. Just before the 2024 election season got underway, Edwards launched a political action committee devoted to civility and cooperation. She called it the Governing Group. Edwards shared with us her observations on how the Republican Party in Utah has changed over the years, and we began with her own connection to it.
Initially, when I registered to vote when I was 18, it just seemed like a natural fit. This would have been in 1978, so this was a very different world then. And I've been part of the Republican Party for, you know, these many years since then. And I have seen an interesting evolution of the party and how that has kind of shifted through the years.
So a month ago or so, the New York Times was doing some reporting on an effort of yours that we'll get to here in a moment. But the reporter mentioned that Utah remained, as he put it, a redoubt of a kinder, gentler, and more civil kind of republicanism. Do you think that's right?
I do think that's right. I've had the privilege of actually campaigning recently for the U.S. Senate and then the congressional special election in 23 for, you know, what ended up amounting to, you know, 2 years almost straight across this state. It's been a tremendous privilege to be in those positions where you're talking to someone in Vernal about what does it mean to them to be a Republican? Why are they involved in the party? Why are they involved in politics? Or why are they not?
Yeah.
And sometimes as they just don't feel heard, because our sense of urgency to the next political meeting, to the next bill, removes us away from really understanding and listening to where people really are.
Okay, but tell me what you heard in Vernal, for example. What did that tell you about the electorate there? Were they driven by on-the-ground kind of issues? Did some of them listen to, I'll just put it this way, Fox News, and we're driven by the sort of rhetoric of the moment, the messaging that you get from certain conservatives? Like, what were they saying? What were you hearing?
I'd say over and over, people, when they were sharing with me things that were important, it was much less about national media that they were either listening to or, you know, adopting into their own mindset, and more about, okay, so you're talking about climate, for example. Yeah. Here's what that means in my community. We've, in the Uinta Basin here, we've got oil and gas and we've got all these things. If those shut down, here's what that means for my family and my neighbors and my community. So over and over, you see these big issues come in a very, very personal way for individuals. How does it impact them and their families? And I'm thinking about, it was actually the state convention for the special congressional election.
Yeah.
And they held the state convention at a high school in Delta. And, you know, the speeches haven't begun yet, but all the candidates are standing in front of their booths and they're waiting for people to come talk to them. And most people are, you know, very respectful, and they come and they just ask a few questions and they move on. There was one gentleman, though, that came and had a lot of passionate viewpoints about bills that I had voted on that I literally could not even remember what he was talking about.
But he was mad.
He was mad.
Yeah.
He was very angry. And as he started to really be very aggressive with me, a small crowd gathered because now this is entertainment. And maybe because I have a background in social work and marriage and family therapy, my heart really went out to this man, and I thought, there's something more than this vote on an obscure bill from 3 years ago that I don't even remember, and it's not even a hot button bill. What's happening here is deeper than he's unhappy about this bill or this bill. And so I started to ask him, hey, hold on one sec. We'll get back to those bills, but tell me about yourself. Now, where are you from? He said, tell me about your family. And when I asked that question, he stopped and tears came to his eyes. And he spoke not as an angry Republican at me, but he spoke as a grandpa and talked about his grandchildren and how heartbroken he was that in his community, there was no future for them. And he just knew they would all be moving away when they graduated from high school and they wouldn't be coming back. There was no future. So we had a talk, and eventually, you know, all the crowd dispersed because there was no more action happening here. We were having a real conversation, and that wasn't nearly as interesting.
Right.
And eventually the man said thanks for the conversation and ended up leaving. And I thought that was such a tender encounter. If I could have those kinds of conversations with every single delegate, you know, I'll probably win this race. Until he turned around as he walked a little bit away, and then he turned around and he said, that was really meaningful. Thanks for taking time to talk to me. Said, still not voting for you, though.
Right.
You know, and it takes a while to move away from some of those deeply held beliefs. But to your question, does that reflect the author in that, you know, New York Times, Utah has a special, kinder, more gentle Republican Party? I do believe that reflects the typical Republican, the average everyday Republican around this state. I really do.
So how is Donald Trump, how has he altered or changed the Republican Party in Utah? And I wonder, maybe I should put it this way. Has Donald Trump's impact on Republicans here been in the way they think about social issues, culture war issues, policy stuff, or has it been more on the kind of political temperament of the party? Has he coarsened the rhetoric?
Well, I think he certainly has given permission to say things and act in certain ways that I think people wouldn't maybe 10 years ago before he came on the scene. But the solution here, I think, speaks a little bit more to where the origin of the problem is, or at least the bulk of the responsibility, because Donald Trump is a symptom, I think, and he— Of a larger problem, yes. And I think we have—
Which is what?
Which is that we have become accustomed to being disagreeable with our neighbors, in our families, in our workplaces, and— it's very, very easy. Let me say it this way. It's very easy to point at a Donald Trump, to one person, and say, look how he has created this problem all across our nation. And we see it in our schools. Our students in our schools are talking back to teachers and they're so disrespectful. We see it in our families. We see it in our workplaces. So it's all his fault. But I think we do ourselves and frankly, Trump a disservice when we think that that's where the solution will be found. If only we could change Trump, everything would be better.
Fine, huh? You helped found this PAC, the governing group. This was in December of 2023. I wanted to ask you about that process, the process that you use in that group when you're talking to candidates. First of all, who are you looking for?
We are looking for candidates who have a track record in their communities of working within their settings and when they have been, you know, in a setting of leadership. And are they people who work with civility? Do they have a focus on problem solving? Are they willing to be held accountable by their constituents? And how do they conduct themselves? Mm. We've never had like a litmus test of we want to make sure you vote yes on this issue, no on this issue.
You don't?
We do not.
Why?
No, because we have long believed that you can have people who come to an issue with that mindset of listening and learning and being civil but also having their own deeply held beliefs. And that can come from anywhere on the political spectrum.
So you're just looking for an open mind. They can have a set principle, but you want them to be willing to at least engage in compromise.
Exactly. Be willing to engage in a civil way and problem solving and solutions oriented, and really dismiss the temptation that I think is so ripe in elected officials to retreat to the margins. So at Governing Group, we've been very thoughtful about the candidates that we've brought in. Last year, the election cycle in 2024 was our first election cycle. And we started off, when we launched in December of 23, we thought maybe we'll just do 5 or 6 people and we'll just, you know, start small. And we ended up having 36 people that we saw from February till November. And some, you know, did not come out of a primary election. And so by the time we ended in the general, we had 28 candidates in the general election. And of those 28 in the general election, 25 won their races. And they were able to win those races in a way that was authentic and real and helped them be, I think, accountable to a different incentive structure than we've seen before within the Republican Party.
So what do you make of the fact that 25 of the 28 won? Were they upfront with a message of civility? Like, was that the thing people were responding to? Like, because that makes me wonder in what direction you think the state is headed. I'm not talking about the political class. I'm talking about voters. Are mainstream rank-and-file Republicans here inclined to go for the centrist, the moderate, the more civil? Is that the right way to put it?
That's exactly what we're seeing. Huh. That is exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing people who have worked very, very hard to identify themselves as, listen, I will be an elected official who listens to you. I will reach out and you will see me treating this process and my colleagues with civility and working hard for you.
You know, the United Utah Party merged with the Utah Forward Party.
Yeah.
There seems to be some, it's pretty small, but there seems to be some interest anyway in a centrist party that steps outside of Republicanism. It sounds like you don't think that's probably terribly practical. Am I right about that?
I think it's an opportunity for people who believe that neither party reflects their viewpoints accurately. And so this provides an opportunity for those individuals to have a place where they can mobilize and, you know, come together. And I admire that.
I guess what I'm asking, though, is are you seeing then this shifting away, put it this way, an interest in other voices, other ways of being that are not characterized by the party itself now? Because it makes me wonder if you think that Donald Trump has changed the Republican Party, the Utah Republican Party in particular, for good, or certainly for a generation.
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if we do nothing, that may be the case. But the more individuals we have who participate in the process, the better off we are. And I am not willing to say wholesale the party is too far gone. I think the party deserves our best efforts to try and help it be a strong, viable, productive, effective body, because there's value in that and it helps shape the political conversation. And as long as that continues to happen, then I think we do not see a generation of voters who are so impacted by Trump, or that it's so damaging, because Utahns are so proud of our individuality. You know, we're so proud of our differences, and this is the Utah way. And maybe every state has, this is the Iowa way, this is the Nebraska way, I don't know. But we think that the Utah way is the best way. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, we're right. We're right, because when we do it well, there's nothing that stops us.
Becky Edwards, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Becky Edwards, she's the founder and a board member of a political action committee called The Governing Group. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Today's program was produced by Katrina Cano, also Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.